Evening, everybody. And I don't have any props tonight. It's just God's word and the microphone, so we'll just do it like that. But I'm going to start with a joke like we usually do, because I truly believe these jokes are part of the torment of your mind, and I'm very grateful to offer that to you. So the joke tonight is very easy. I think most of you get it. I know most of your families, so therefore I think most of you will get it. So here's the joke. What is 1/10 short of a circus? What is 1/10 short of a circus? Starts with an F. What's 1/10? A family. My family. Your family. What's 1/10 short of a circus? Your family. And that's what we've been talking about here the whole time is Crazy RS. The workshop on family development, and not just family development, but I really believe it's a workshop on church development, because the church comprises families. And this is the third installment of this workshop. We have one more. Next week we're going to get into framework of resiliency, but today we're going to zoom into one of my most favorite parts of it, and that's development. But before we get there, let's just rehash where we've been just for a second. So the next slide you'll see, on week one, we jumped into defining what is a family. And we really got into the complexities and the emotional dynamics of a family, because we really had to start there where we were. And of course, we saw that the Bible taught us that a family is one of its primary roles is to rule and subdue. But it's not one of those kind of beaten over the heads rule and subdue. To rule in this sense is to defend the defenseless, to stand up for the oppressed. And we saw that flow out of Genesis chapters 1 and 2. And then, of course, we jumped into this idea that each family has a mission. And the mission, of course, I think is pretty seriously obvious to us. The mission is to help our children and our extended family members to look at life through a Christian worldview. We should be and point them through that stained glass window where they define their experiences through their faith in Christ. That's ultimately the mission of a family. And of course, there's a concern that's associated with that. There's a concern for every family. And John really kind of talks about this in that second epistle when John writes in the fourth verse, "It has given me great joy to find some of your children walking in the truth." If you remember, we focused on that word "some." It gives them great joy to find some of the children walking in the truth. So we want to be careful that the "some" doesn't include us. That's the concern. Because at the end of the day, I think we all realize that we have the tendency to drift as individuals, individual Christians, as Christian families, and as churches. It's a tendency of every Christian to become more secular with the passage of time. So we have to just be aware of this. And that's the concern. Now, of course, there's a "for this reason." For this reason, God has chosen the family to transmit godly lifestyle and value. That's the point. So that's really what we jumped into that first week. The second week, we took that and we ran that through how to manage conflict. Because we understand, with all the complexities and certainly with all the emotional dynamics of a family, conflict is inevitable. If you're in a relationship for more than 3.8 seconds, you're going to have some sort of conflict. And it usually has to do with power, gaining power or losing power. But at the end of the day, conflict is inevitable. You can't avoid it. You might as well learn how to manage it. And that's what we talked about last week. Conflict, unfortunately, though, is a lot of times managed in auto mode. We just react to it. Somebody pulls out in front of us, we react to it. Somebody takes something that belongs to us, we react to it. So the goal is to step out of the reactionary mode and become more responsive to the situation. This takes a lifetime of development, but we have to get on that pathway of responding. And of course, we understand that a lot of our reactions flow from our family of origin, and it flows from that habit loop that we stepped into quite deeply last week. And the concern, of course, like the first week, the concern for the second week has to do with the accelerator, right? A conflict is the great accelerator. Either it accelerates a family closer together, or it accelerates a family further apart. It is the great, it's the fuel that accelerates a family's growth, or it's the fuel that accelerates a family's falling apart. And so for this reason, I think we all came to the conclusion last week that I need to intentionally develop how I manage conflict. And this is so incredibly true at a church level. If the church doesn't learn how to manage conflict, it's just going to be a mess. So we have to be very intentional about this. We can't sweep it under the rug. This is the kind of things we talked about last week. And at the end of the day, we wanted to remind ourselves that God has designed family or the home as a retreat where children and family members can retreat to and experience life. There's a dining room for dining, a kitchen for cooking, a living room for living, and there's no room for belittling, and there's no room for screaming at each other. The family, the home, should be a retreat. I don't know if any of you took me up on the offer and memorized Ephesians chapter 4, verse 29, but it's one of my most favorite passages in this particular part of Paul's writings, because he says to the church, do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, not according to my needs. That's the goal. That's what we want our children to be raised in. Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths except that what is useful for building others up according to their needs. That's the memory verse that prepared you for today's lesson, and that's what we want. We want families to be intentional. So today, that's what we're going to talk about. If we go to the next slide, we're going to talk about intentionality. We are reminded of the truth that we started a workshop with. Healthy Christian families produce healthy Christians, right? And the opposite's true. Unhealthy Christian families produce unhealthy Christians. That's the truth statement that we started with. And so we just want to kind of take that to that place where we think it through together. And what we want to do is we want to learn how to intentionally develop a family, right? We want to not lose sight of the main thing, the main thing. And we're going to talk about that in a second, but we don't want to lose sight of the main thing. We want to embody the scriptures that we hold so dearly to our hearts. Like in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7, when Jesus brings to us the Sermon on the Mount, and he describes to us what the kingdom should be looking like in our hearts, in our families, and in the churches that we gather as a family. It's the kingdom. It isn't the checkoff box to get into the kingdom. We declare our faith in Jesus the Christ, the Son of the living God, and join with him in Christian baptism. We are then ushered into the kingdom. And when we're ushered into the kingdom, this is how we're supposed to live. Through the Sermon on the Mount, these Beatitudes are so spot on for the children and for our grandkids and nieces and nephews, where Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit, those who have been emptied of themselves. They're poor in spirit in the sense that they don't have that pride that always separates them from somebody. Blessed are those who mourn, not so much over losing a loved one, but they mourn over their sin. Blessed are those who stop justifying their sin. Blessed are the meek, the humble, humility. Not thinking less of ourselves, right? Just thinking of ourselves less often. That's the characteristics of the kingdom in your home. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. I love mercy. Most of us love mercy. For me, keeping it simple, mercy just simply means not getting what we deserve. Grace is getting what we don't deserve. Mercy is not getting what we do deserve. I used to demand justice. I want justice, but now I really would be in the front line for mercy. And that's because I have mourned over my sin. And so, mercy, is your home characterized by mercy? Do you let people off the hook? This is the kingdom that we're, and then going from here, blessed are the pure in heart, the pure in heart. I like to look at this as simply, one of the facets of this is simply to look at people the way God sees them, pure in heart, to see people as God sees them. Blessed are the peacemakers. We talked about that last week. For they will be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Then he goes on, blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. This passage means a lot, and it certainly is applicable to our families. It certainly is applicable, and this is what we want to embody in our families. We want to embody what Paul wrote in Romans chapter 12, verse 2, when he says, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world. What's the pattern of your world? What's the pattern of your children's world? Is it fitting in at all costs? Is it hatred? What's the pattern of your kids' world? Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. This is what we want our families to develop into. Or like Paul says in that beautiful passage in Philippians, which is so much in there about humility, but at the end of it in chapter 2, he says, shine like stars as you hold out the word of life. These are the things we want our families to embody. And on and on and on. We could go on and on and on about this. And we need to, because we want families who shine light, who walk in the truth, who develop a home that is a retreat. Because at the end of the day, if we're not intentional about development, there's a lot of other things out there perfectly willing to develop your children for you, or your grandkids, or your nieces and nephews, or the kids that attend this school. There's lots of people waiting in line to develop your children for you. Like this picture, this cartoon. I love this cartoon. I stumbled across it. I'm not sure if you could read the words in the caption, but what it says is, isn't it great to have some quality time with the family? That's what the caption says. But you can see they're all holding electronic devices, social media driven devices that have pulled each one of them out of the family. They're all sitting in the same room, being influenced by different things. Even the stupid dog is being influenced by something else. And this is what we see. Oh my goodness, it's what we see. I don't know if your homes have a rule for social media, electronic devices. What I always tell people is no bedrooms, bathrooms, or dining room tables. Those should be sacred spots for electronic devices. No bedrooms, bathrooms, or dining room tables. Those should be places where phones and social media do not poison. No bedrooms, bathrooms, or dining room tables. Because that way we can influence and develop the children intentionally as Christ would have us do it. Because it's really hard. If you go to the next slide, you'll see it's really hard to hold the main thing. This is my friend Daryl. I think I can call him a friend. He would still call me a friend, I think. But this is, remember, we started off with Daryl over here. And we were stacking all kinds of things on. I put my grandparents on his head so he wouldn't drop them. But that ball is to represent the main thing, which is our focus on Christ. And with all the stuff going on in our lives, all the complexities associated with families, the emotional dynamics, we're supposed to not drop the main thing. Now, you'll see the picture on the right. He has already dropped the main thing. I didn't even ask him. I was supposed to ask him if he could invite Miranda up to give her a hug, holding all that stuff, but he had already dropped the main thing, so I didn't even bother doing that. It's really hard to show affection to our spouses when we're so packed full of stuff, and we wonder why we have relational problems in our marriages. We're going to talk about that today a little bit, because as we mentioned the first week, a divorce in the family propagates through three generations in the genogram. The sap that runs through the family tree is affected when a limb of the tree is broken off. And so we want to be intentional about our marriages so that our children are intentional about. So this is all we're talking about today. And of course, I like to paint a pretty dynamic picture in the front end so people listen. This is a big deal. How in the world are we to develop our children with all this mess going on? Well, that's the big question. How do we do that? Well, the answer is right there. I mean, it's responsibility focused through intentionality. Now, to be clear, you're sitting at the Harlan, at the Church of Christ at Harlan on a Wednesday evening. So intentionality, responsibility, you're expressing by just being here. So I don't want to make it sound like you're not already doing this. It's progress, not perfection. We just continue to do it more and more. But it's intentionality developed through permanency. We're going to step into what those two things, intentionality and permanency. Because I believe if we're intentional with our children and those we have influence over, and we remain consistent in their lives, God will take that and do amazing things for us. He'll do amazing things for us. Now, in order for us to kind of step through this, we need to start someplace. And the place we need to start at, I would suggest, at least tonight, is understanding our shape. So if you go to the next slide, you'll see this acronym, SHAPE, it's not mine invention. I stole it. It's been around for a long time. I'm just using it tonight. Most of the stuff I say has come from somebody else besides me, and that's my disclaimer. But the shape, in order for us to develop, we need to understand our shape, right? Not just our physical shape, but our emotional shape, our spiritual shape, the shape of your children, the shape of your niece or nephew, or the child running through the hallways at the Harlan Christian School. What's their shape? And how do you develop their shape? So I need to really quickly unpack that acronym, SHAPE. So, of course, the S, as you see, stands for spiritual gifts. The H stands for heart or your passion. The abilities is the A. The P is for personality. And the E is for experiences. You would be surprised how much of the Bible flows through this acronym in understanding some of our most beloved biblical characters, the shape of a person. And in order for a person to develop, you need to know their shape to start with. And so just jumping into this, the S for spiritual gifts. To be clear, spiritual gifts, I believe, are quite a simple concept. I know the church historically has confused it tremendously, but a spiritual gift in the Greek is simply an occasion of grace. We don't earn gifts. We don't develop gifts. I would suggest gifts are simply revealed to us. And we have different spiritual gifts for different areas in our life. You may have a particular spiritual gift at the church and a different one at your place of employment and a different one at your home compared to on the soccer field. A spiritual gift is the same in all those places in that it is designed to bring about the declaration of the gospel, a spiritual gift. I mean, we know there's several lists in the Bible, not exhaustive. I'm sure you've been taught that any list you find in the Bible is not exhaustive. It's just an example. So Paul wrote to the church at Rome with a list of gifts. In Romans chapter 12, Paul says, For by the grace given me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment in accordance with the measure of the faith God has given you. And then in 12:4, Paul writes and says, just as each one of you has one body with many members, and each of these members do not have all the same function, so in Christ, we who are many form one body, and each member belongs to the others. I wanted to read that first part because he's using the body of Christ concept. And then in verse 6, he says, we have different gifts. And in the Greek, that's the word for grace, charis. We have different gifts according to the grace given us. If a man's gift is prophesying, let him use it in proportion to his faith. If it is serving, let him serve. If it is teaching, let him teach. If it is encouraging, let him encourage. If it is contributing to the needs of others, let him give generously. If it is leadership, let him govern diligently. If it is showing mercy, let him do it cheerfully. This is a sample listing of gifts that Paul thought would be good for the church at Rome to be reminded of. But at the end of the day, we all have gifts. Your children have spiritual gifts. They may not have had the occasion to have those gifts revealed to them, but I believe it is the parents and grandparents, especially grandparents, responsibility to help the children discover their gifts. And of course, we discover our gifts a lot of times as we're serving. That's why we love when families come to the Woodburn Christian Children's Home to do a work project. Each one of the family members gets to discover their gift as a result of it, possibly. Or serving through the church, or serving in the neighborhood, or wherever we serve at, it's an occasion to discover our gifts. A lot of times, the gift a person has is best recognizable by somebody other than the person who has it. And so we need to be with our family of God, who then can point out and say, you know what, your daughter, she just has this gift of leadership. Or your son, he has a gift of mercy. He's able to show mercy. And a lot of times we hear these from the people that we're with. Spiritual gifts can be developed as they're uncovered. So I guess the question to you is, have you considered the spiritual gifts of your children, no matter what age they are, or your extended family, or maybe some of the kids in the classrooms that you teach? The shape of a child is so incredibly important for us to understand. If we go on from there and we go to the second letter, the heart, or a person's passion, that is so wonderful to see developed in a child. The passion, the word passion comes from the Latin root passio, and it means path in a sense, but it's always used as described in a path of suffering. Interestingly enough, that the word passion comes from the Latin root that's often used to describe a path of suffering, because a lot of times our passion causes us to suffer. There's obviously biblical. There's biblical passion that is very much dangerous. We're warned not to be given over to. But there's also biblical passion that is very much designed to build us up. That passion can be good or bad. It could be sinful or righteous. Obviously, we know most of the time that passion typically overrides rationality. We kind of set that aside as we're thinking it through. Paul wrote to the Romans that God had given them over to their sinful passions in Romans chapter 1, verse 26, the foundation of the gospel. And obviously that's negative. But we also read in different parts of the Bible how God has given Christians over to righteous passion. His son, Jesus the Christ, was given over to righteous passion. You remember that passage in Matthew? In John chapter 2, when Jesus went down from Capernaum with his mother and brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days, and then it was time for the Passover in John chapter 2, verse 13. It was time for the Passover, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. You remember this passage? In the temple courts, he found what? Men selling cattle, sheep, doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple area, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. How dare you turn my father's house into a market?" His disciples remembered at that moment that it is written in the Old Testament, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Zeal. Old Testament 12-gauge zeal, New Testament passion. I believe every Christian needs to have a passion that drives them. Your children have a passion that drives, they just haven't uncovered it yet. I love studying the life of Paul because it reminds me that it's okay to be passionate. You know, he was passionate to oppose the church, and then he became passionate to proclaim the Christ. In Acts chapter 14, he's free-falling through the Middle East, preaching in Lystra and Derbe, and he gets chased out of there, and he's heading down to Antioch and Iconium in Acts 14, 19, and he won the crowd over in Antioch and Iconium, but some Jews came down, and they stoned Paul and dragged him outside the city, thinking he was dead. But after the disciples had gathered around him, he got up and went back into the city. The next day, he and Barnabas left for Derbe. You know, that's not one of your paycheck passions. I mean, he got taken out of the city, thrown into a pit, because typically they throw you in a pit to stone you, so they don't touch the dead body, which would make them ceremonial unclean. So they threw him into a pit and were stoning him to death, thinking he was dead, but he wasn't. And he got up. Instead of leaving, he went back into the city. I think that's Old Testament 12-gauge passion. Just don't tell me what to do. I think too often Christians have given in to this mediocreness, this nominal way of living. There's a book written that God doesn't want fans. He wants followers, people who are thrown over by passion. I had this professor at Johnson Bible College who told me, Dr. Reese, he's since passed away. He told all of us, he said, every Christian should have something that they're willing to pick up a chair and throw it across the room over. There should be something that you find so appalling in your neighborhood that you're just not going to stand up for it anymore. In the name of Christ, you're going to do something about it. I remember I was serving at the Auburn Church of Christ, and down the block was a gas station. And it took under new ownership, and this guy at the gas station started selling marijuana pipes and bongs to smoke marijuana. And I was sickened by it. It just sickened me. And it got to the point, I was tired. It was Monday. Most preachers do dumb things on Monday. So I got up from my desk, and I went down to the gas station, and the owner was there. And I asked him, why in the world are you selling marijuana pipes in our neighborhood? Why are you selling bongs in our neighborhood? And we got into a little disagreement about that. I was sick and tired of that garbage being in the neighborhood. Is that going to fix a drug and alcohol problem that's permeating this country? No. But I'm sick of it. I've seen too many families ruined because of it. Every Christian needs to have a passion. What's your passion? Do your kids know what your passion is? Do you know what your kids' passion is? Have you helped them to develop it? Maybe they're sick and tired of the bullying. Or maybe they're just sick and tired of the garbage that happens on social media. Or maybe they can't stand for the kid who's always outcast. I don't know what your kids' passion are. I can guarantee you they have one, though. And I think it's our responsibility to intentionally help them develop their passion so that the cause of Christ is proclaimed. Shape. It's all over the New Testament. Stephen, he had a passion. Took him to the grave. Paul, of course, had the passion. Isaiah, when God came to Isaiah in that beautiful passage in chapter 6 of his writings, he heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And, of course, Isaiah responded and said, here I am, send me. That's passion. It's all over the New Testament. Too often, I think, we let our passions get whittled down, and we forget what we've been called to do. And so this is a reminder to me. I was convicted by this when I was writing this today and tweaking it. So I don't want to go on and on about the passion, but it's so incredibly important. I'm not going to spend that much time on the other letters. The abilities, of course, abilities can be developed. Gifts are uncovered. So the ability to do something. Moses, you remember the burning bush experience Moses had? When God was talking to Moses at the burning bush, and Moses was kind of hee-hawing around about the call. And then Moses said to the Lord in chapter 4 of Exodus, O Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither in past nor since. You have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. The Lord said to him, who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go. I will help you speak and will teach you what to say. Moses had to develop the ability of public speaking, of which he did really, really well in the desert. And too often I think we have to have all the abilities in place before we set out to do something. I'm a firm believer that when we answer the call, God then begins to develop us to fulfill the call. I have never been ready to fulfill the call that I've been asked to. And that's the step of faith. And your children, I think they need to understand this framework of thinking. They really do, because too often, middle school, high school robs our kids of their self-esteem and of their confidence. We have to pour it back into them. And we do it with this. So abilities is big. You know, certainly personality, that's a whole other workshop. I love studying personality. I've been doing it for quite a while. And I did it when I was doing my master's in sociology, which I didn't want to do, but I had to do because that was what was required at a children's home. But it turned out to be a really wonderful experience. And personality is one of the things I zoomed into. And that's amazing. Start understanding your children's personality. introverted versus extroverted. That doesn't mean shy or outgoing necessarily. Introverted kids have a different type of friendship. It's usually one or two deeply rooted friendships compared to an extroverted child who has a whole bunch of friendships, but they're not very deep. So an introverted child, when they lose one of those treasured friendships, that is earth-shattering to them. Do you have an introverted child or grandchild? Do you have an extroverted one? Also, this personality also helps us understand how kids read in information. Some children read it in intuitively. My wife once bought a card because it winked at her. I can say that because she's not here tonight. And I was furious. I mean, I just met her. I'm like, oh my gosh, what kind of whack job is mine? What do you have, like candles and seances? You bought a card because it winked at you. She says, yeah, it had the right feeling. I was like, did you look at it? Did you take it to a mechanic? No, I just thought it just felt right. I was like, oh, turned out to be one of the best cars we ever owned. She gathers data intuitively. I'm more of a engineer, show me the facts, research it for 3 months, and then another 6 months, and then maybe we'll make a decision in 2 years from now. That's kind of how I'm wired. So I'm more of a sensing who, what, when, where, why. I'm more of a, you know, touch, feel, see, taste, you know, grab and strangle kind of thing. And so personalities, how we make decisions, how we gather data, and how we interact with our social environment, that's a huge thing. And you could really help your kids help them understand their personality. There's some assessments you could do. Now, they're not real valid when they're under 25 years old, but at least it gets them thinking about it. They'll like say, like, you know, like they're kind of like this animal or that. I mean, there's ways of helping kids get an idea of their personality because it helps them understand why they do what they do. And then the last letter, experiences, that really brings it all together. Experiences, every child has a unifying experience. Sometimes it happens middle school, high school, sometimes at college age, or maybe after some experience. It could be positive or negative. It could be that maybe the death of a friend in a car accident. Our son had a death of a friend in a car accident. Two friends of his died instantly in a car accident. High school football players up in DeKalb. That was a unifying experience from he is no longer the one. He was not the child he was before that. He is completely different now. And we had to work through that with him. It's still going on now. The passing of my mother brought all that stuff back up for him again. And that's, experiences are huge. It doesn't have to be something as traumatic as that. It could be a positive experience. It could be, you know, working through that difficult class and getting a B or even a C. Experiences unify. Like for me, you know, I grew up in an abusive home. Then I came out of the home onto the street as a teenager and led an abusive life on the street. And that abusive experience has given me the passion to want to help children who've had a rough start as well. And God has given me the gifts to be able to do that. He's helped me develop the abilities for it, and I've got the personality to come alongside some of these kids. So experiences kind of bring it all together. And it's really important, I would suggest, for each one of you to sit down and just help them think through the acronym. I do it at church youth camps all the time. Kids love it. You 2, 3, 4 years later, I'll get an email from somebody who say, you know, that SHAPE acronym you went through at Michiana 3 years ago, it makes sense now, and this is what I'm doing. You would be surprised how they can wrap their brains around it. So this is a big part of what I wanted to talk about tonight is the SHAPE acronym. S-H-A-P-E. And from there, we're going to step into this next slide, which now that we understand the SHAPE, we can come back to this slide. This was presented to you once before. Hal and I did it. I believe it was on a Sunday evening, and we talked about the developmental domains that we at the Woodburn Christian Children's Home look at. It's not rocket science. It's just every kid develops physically, educationally, emotionally, and spiritually. And there's overlapping domains. They all overlap. And at the Woodburn Christian Children's Home, they overlap on the cross. Everything we do, every physical lesson we teach flows through the cross. Now, we don't usually tell them that because they'll usually resist it then. Educationally, emotionally, everything flows through what we believe, even if the kids don't believe. You don't have to be a Christian to show up at the children's home. You don't have to be a Christian to leave the children's home. We would like it if you were, but that's sometimes we're planting seeds, sometimes we're watering it, sometimes we're harvesting it. And that's just the reality of what we live in. Traumatized kids don't trust anybody, especially adults. And for us to beat them over the head with the Bible and say, you have to believe this, or you have to do this because of what the Bible says, it's usually a spinning of the tires. And we know that. We pray and pray and pray, and we covet your prayers for it. But at the end of the day, we're just trying to help them along the way and get them a little further down the path than they were before. It's like what C.S. Lewis said about the spring. You know, the springtime affects everything in that particular creation. It doesn't matter what it is, the tree, the grass, the birds, they're all affected by it, even if they don't know God exists. And so at the children's home, they're all affected by our faith, even if they don't believe God exists. And that's true in your families. Your child may come home and say, I don't believe in God anymore. Looking for you to freak out. and we can't ignore that, obviously. We have to address that, but how we address that is difficult sometimes. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit here. You know, the physical developmental zone or domain. You know, this stuff, like we talked about back in the, I think it was in the early part of this year or late last year, you know, we talked about the typical things you would think about with physical development. Dietary, of course, you know, we are what we eat kind of thing. Exercise, this goes back to that HALT acronym, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. We don't manage conflict real well when we're hungry. Oh, my goodness, I don't manage conflict well when I'm hungry. Angry, if something's got me going over here, I typically transverse that over to here. I'm really good at compartmentalizing things, but not my anger. So it goes with me everywhere I go. Hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. That's that physical stuff. You know, I don't watch the second half of the Monday Night Football games anymore. I think NFL football has gotten really whacked anyway, so it's easy for me not to. But I used to stay up late till 12:30 at night watching the Eagles blow it at the last minute and then feel like garbage for 3 days. And so that affects how. So I have to be responsible to my family to not stay up to watch the second half. That's that physical development. Dietary, exercise, work ethics. Oh, my goodness. We got to teach our kids work ethics. They've got good work ethics. The children home kids, oh, my goodness, they could work you to death. They're strong in their work ethics once you get them going. It's like rolling a snowball up a hill, though, sometimes. And Daryl and Miranda can certainly attest to that. But that work ethics, and the best way to teach work ethics, of course, is to work alongside of them. If they're going to go pull the weeds, guess who has to go with them? Us. And so that's part of the teaching. And then the big thing I want to touch on here is the rhythm of your family. The daily, weekly, monthly, yearly rhythm. What's the rhythm of your family? You know, for Vicki and I, we had four kids. We have four kids, and the youngest now is 20. And when they were younger, they wanted to do all kinds of extracurricular activities. And the answer was no, you get one. You choose one. This is how you choose. This is the pros and cons. We went through to teach them how to choose, but you're not each doing three things. You're not going to drive us crazy. We didn't have you to drive us crazy. We had you so we could drive you crazy. I mean, it was kind of they got it all crooked there, but we outlawed all activities except for one per kid. And they were always, of course, resisting. We told them that's because we want to keep the rhythm of the family. We want to keep the rhythm. So that we could do recreational things together, so that we could do hobbies together, so it all fits in the rhythm. And that's why one of the reasons I stopped traveling for a living, I used to travel, you know, like, you know, domestically and internationally. I did that for 11 years, 100,000 air miles a year. That was no rhythm to that life. And I got off the road as a result of it because I realized what was happening to the kids. So that's part of the deal, this physical, and it requires us to inventory how we're living. How is your family physically living? Your children will reproduce that rhythm now and in their families when they get older. So then we take the educational developmental domain. What is the value of learning in your family? Is it one of those, oh, you're never going to use that, just let me help you get this stupid homework done so we can move on? Or is there a value to learning? Is learning just something that's done during the school year? My wife used to punish our kids. Well, it wasn't punishment, it was fun. She used to have school all through summer with them. But she made it fun until they became middle schoolers. And then, you know, they're all whack jobs at middle school. But we try anyway. But she valued learning. And not just learning academics, though, but life skill, which pulls all the academics together. Have you taught your kids how to balance a checkbook? You know, have you taught your kids how to find a mortgage, or how to deal with telemarketers, or how to deal with the folks with even managing the AT&T or Verizon plans? They all need to learn how to do this. If we don't teach them, I can guarantee you somebody is very happy to teach your kids all they need to know about what not to do. So if we're not intentional about life skill, pre-vocational exploration, taking your kids, your nieces, your nephews, your grandkids to that workplace to check out what these folks do. And I think it's just so incredibly important for us to think about educational development. Because, I mean, I think we, I didn't realize it at first, but, you know, the schools, they see the kids 6 or 8 hours a day, 8 to 9 months a year, and we see the kids 16 hours a day sometimes, and then 12 months out of the year. We are the primary teacher for our children. Oftentimes we farm our kids out to be taught by the schools or by the Boy Scouts or by the 4-H. All very valid, obviously, platforms of learning, but it's only tied together through the family. So then the next one here is the emotional development. This is a huge part, I think, of what we have to really, I don't know, for me, I had to really kind of put my brain around the emotional side of things. Helping my kids helping them to wrestle with expectations and entitlement. They should expect a safe home, but what else should they expect? Should they expect to get $120 sneakers? Not in my house, but nonetheless, it's just expectation and entitlement. Processing grief. You know, my son's two best friends died in a car accident. We had over 40 of his friends from DeKalb High School wandering around our house that night because none of them knew how to process what they just experienced. And teenagers define life through their peer culture. And their peer culture was confronted with something that wasn't able to understand. How could these two who were standing here right before they, you know, it was at 4:30 they left and they died at 4:45. How could these two be here and then gone now? They wandered around the neighborhood. We took them over to the Auburn Church of Christ and had a candlelight service. We didn't know what to do. We just took them to the cross and sang and cried. And that became a long journey. Do your kids know how to process grief? Have they ever heard of the 5 stages of grief from you? It's important for us to talk about emotional movement, processing joy and victory and peace and identity and all these, you know, participating in setting that emotional set point of the house that we talked about. And the big thing for emotional development that we found, it's called the Sticky Faith Initiative. It came out of the Fuller Institute several years ago. And what it tries to tell us and teach us is that every teenager needs 5 essential relationships outside of their family of origin in order to stick to the faith. Now, those 5 relationships are supposed to be found in the church. So you know what these kids are being taught by these 5 relationships. But a lot of times, teenagers, we lose our voice. We get it back when they're about 22 years old. But about 12 or 13 years old, we lose our voice. Grandma and grandpa become real loud in their lives. So does aunts and uncles, but especially the people in the church. Kids need 5 essential relationships to stick to the faith. The relationships that they form in the sound booth, or they form putting the chairs up. And then when they get their driver's license, those people celebrate it with them. When they get the D instead of the F, they celebrate it with them. It's just important for us to understand the emotional connectivity of our children to the church. Because at the end of the day, I think we understand that there's a lot of people willing to develop our kids for us. A lot of marketing folks, a lot of people with masters in sociology are carefully designing what they're receiving based on their spending habits so they could develop them into better spenders for what they're selling. Happens all the time. I don't know if you realize it, but the ads that show up in your mailbox at your home address is different than your neighbor's because they're monitoring your spending activities and they're developing the ads to what you, they know what trimester you're in. My daughter was receiving stuff for her second trimester when she was in her first because they knew she was pregnant based on what she was buying. That's crazy stuff. There's a lot of people out there who want to develop your kids, and spiritually, that's a huge part of what we know we have to. If we go to the next slide, we have to root our identity in Christ. And I'm going to finish with this. This is a funny cartoon, but not really. Shoot, son, if you work real hard and stick to it, I reckon you can impersonate anyone you want. Kids absolutely strive for an identity. They'll do anything to fit in. Anything. I mean, absolutely anything to fit in. And whoever they're standing next to, they'll become like. It's the chameleon effect that's so prevalent in our schools. They stand next to the soccer players, they want to play soccer. I can't tell you how many kids I know. I ask them, why are you playing soccer? Oh, my friends were. Why are you playing football? Oh, my friends were. Their whole decision on why they're doing what they're doing is based on what their friends are doing. So if their friends are playing soccer, that's safe. If they're playing football, that's safe. If they're smoking weed behind the bleachers on a Friday night football game, that's not safe. They will do whatever it takes to fit in. And so we have to be really careful to root their spiritual development in Christ. And then this next slide shows us this happens on, again, this is what we talked about a few months ago, the platform of permanency. The kids will develop physically, educationally, emotionally, and spiritually connected through faith only if the adults in their life are available, predictable, and accountable. We're going to use this as the kind of the diving board for next week's final lesson. I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but think about availability, predictability, and accountability. Where are you in that? With your children and with your family. Available, predictable, and accountable. All children flourish in an environment like that. It's hard for us to manage that. So we're going to talk about that next week because we want to get into that resiliency. Because families are going to experience, like the trampoline, they're going to experience stuff that stretches them. We have to learn to be resilient so that we can continue on the developmental path. Thanks for letting me talk. You've given my wife a really nice break tonight. So, thanks.